وبه نستعين وهو خير ناصر ومعين وصلى الله على محمد وعليه الطاهرين اللهم صل على محمد وعلى آله. Many of us might have questions in regards to philosophy, and particularly in regards to Islamic philosophy, because the Orientalists have criticized Islamic philosophy to be continuation or to be taken from the Greek philosophy. Nevertheless, the beginning of philosophy and the prehistoric philosophy, if one kind of look into history, the founding fathers of philosophy such as Plato, for instance, we do find commonality existing between the Islamic philosophy and the Greek philosophy. So it's a continuation of that, but rather not that it has been taken from. Because the philosophers of the past who used intellectual, logical, and philosophical arguments to prove God, such as Plato and Aristotle, were praised by the Imams themselves as well. You know, we do have traditions from Imam Sadiq alayhi salam, which praises Plato and Aristotle and call them that they were the men of God, and may peace be upon them. May Allah bless them. Why it is so important to really learn philosophy? Maybe I'm asking you now. You can share your comments with us here. Why it is so important? Yes, Bismillah. It teaches you how to think. It teaches you how to think. Philosophy teaches you how to think. So thinking is very important in Islam, is it? You know, the Quran have continuously emphasized that we should contemplate, that we should ponder, that we should think. So Islam is a religion that encourages us to really think. It's not just where we blindly follow. More philosophy, which really means that love of knowledge, you know, knowledge, wisdom, which Islam promotes, which Islam wants us to be wise, to really learn. It's quite important. Why is it important? Why? What will happen? What is the end result of it? Ma'rifat, you know, brother says ma'rifat, which is understanding and knowing, ma'rifat of everything that is around us, the things that we deal with, ma'rifat of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala eventually, obviously. So knowing and having knowledge of things that we interact is very important. Knowledge of knowing oneself is very important. And all of these different types or kinds of knowledge of things around us, of ourself, eventually will provide us with a deeper understanding of God. And our journey is that. Our journey is to know God, and that's what we are created for. The Jannah and the hereafter is nothing but that. You know, we talk about Jannah being this, you know, having castles, having rivers, and so on and so forth. Yes. But all in all is nothing but knowing. You know, the more it's knowing God. The more we know God, the more closer we will be to God. So therefore, to really have a deeper understanding of things and having knowledge and understanding of realities that is around us is important. It helps us in our prayers. It helps us in our faith, in our iman. So now when we look at the different definitions of philosophy, after we know that it is so important and we should know, and we live only once. It's not that we're gonna, you know, we are reborn and we will be given another chance to really know. If we do our homework here, then obviously there are other levels of knowledge that we need to learn. It's like if someone who hasn't finished his high school and wants to, you know, do his master's, he will be asked to finish his high school first. And then after that he could go to do his master's. So the same way, if someone who haven't understood the different levels of Tawheed, the in-depth understanding of the existence of the angels, what material they come from, what genus they have, what type of angels they are, what really Ismat means, what really, you know, Nabuwat means, what really Qiyamat means, even after Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala sending the book and opening the path to reach where no man have ever reached, وَقَانَ قَابِعَوْ قَوْسَيْنَ وَأَدْنَى, where the Prophet reached, and Prophet provided with that sort of method through which we could reach that level of nearness to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, then we have to redo those things again in Barzakh and the hereafter. So if we try to dedicate and spend some time towards these deeper understanding, it is worthwhile, and we have to do it. The definitions that we have seen in Greek philosophers, they say philosophy is the knowledge of all existing things qua existence, meaning that the knowledge of things itself, in essentially. Knowledge of the divine and human matter. Philosophy is becoming God-like to the extent of human ability. As we said that man have been created in the image of God, and he wants his soul to be like God-like as well. So it's becoming God-like, not only in just the form that Adam is, but even his akhlaq, his ruh, you know, his behavior should become God-like. And this has been a journey, or this has been with human being, with insan, right from the very beginning of Adam alayhi salam. So when the Greek philosophers are talking about to become God-like, to really know, I mean, that doesn't mean that, you know, they were not. If Muslims are talking about that, or Islamic philosophers are talking about that, that doesn't mean that they are stealing from the Greek philosophers. You know, it's just a continuation of that, and making that knowledge which pre-existed, so to speak, and crystallize it and make that reach to its perfect level. Now, the definition that we find among the Islamic philosophers, such as Kindi. Kindi is known as the first teacher. You know, he is known as the first philosopher in Islam. Now, one would say that, what about the Imams? What about the Prophets? Of course, you know, we are looking at the history of Islamic philosophy here. We are looking at philosophy as we are looking philosophy objectively. We are looking at philosophy, subjectively, as a subject, as a knowledge that was given a form, a structure, and called as philosophy, as Islamic philosophy, rather than we are looking at, you know, Quran, belief system, you know, hadith, riwayat, and religion, but we are looking at from an academic point of view, what is really Islamic philosophy, and how philosophy plays a great role in our iman, in our belief. One really have to have a deeper understanding of history of philosophy itself to really bring that sort of iman in us. Kindi, who basically was born in 801 AD, he was a contemporary to Imam Hadi alayhi salam. He was present there at that time. He has dedicated many of his philosophical texts to the Khalifa of that time, and he also had certain guidance from the Imams as well. But he was an independent thinker, perhaps not a Shia, but there were scholars existing at that time as well. But he wasn't like a companion, like a follower of the Imams. He was contemporary to the Imam, and he died in 873 AD, but he's known as the first philosopher, where he defines philosophy as a knowledge of the reality of things within people's possibility, because the philosopher and in theoretical knowledge is to gain the truth, the haqiqat, the truth which is Allah, and also to practice in accordance to that knowledge that he has gained. So you always have the element of practice even among the philosophers as well. You know, they practiced what they have learned. If they see that speaking truth, if one looks at the ethics of Aristotle, you know, you would find that Aristotle not only come to terms with what he has gained, he practiced as well, you know, meaning that Aristotle, when he's writing Philosophy of Ethics, then he was a true practice, a person who truly practiced what he has gained, what he has learned. Farabi, who is known as the second teacher, he describes philosophy where he says that while accepting the above definition, he points out to that it is based on certainty, on yaqeen, and on opinion. Hence, dialectic and sophistry. This was a new sort of challenge that existed during Farabi's time, which is 872. He was born and he died in 950. So we are looking at that period. So still, Islam was forming, in the sense, was growing, and there were these philosophers who discuss, who compare to compare the treaties that were translated from Greek to Arabic, and they added to those theories and treaties that were existing. Ibn Sina, the most famous one, Avicenna, which is known in English, he regards hikmah, where philosophy is the perfection of human soul through tasavvur, conceptualization. Tasavvur, we all have that ability. We all been provided with that quwwah, with that sense perception, with that quality of imagining. We all can imagine, can't we? You know, this is something given by Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. So now we have to use our imagination. Now, whether this imagination is correct or not, then we have to use our intellect, our aql, our logic, to really see whether this imagination is true. Just like dreams. We all have dreams, don't we? You know, these dreams are based on our imagination. Now, if I am imagining a person with two heads, you know, we will see a dream with a person with two heads. Now, whether a person with two heads exists or not, philosophy will teach us that. You know, philosophy will tell us that, whether a person with two heads exists, for example, or not. So therefore, Ibn Sina says it's that tasavvur, it's crystallization of that tasavvurat, of that imagination. Yes, we could have read something, the qualities of God in the Quran, about Jannah, about Qiyamah. You know, we could imagine it. Now, whether these imagination is correct intellectually or not, sound intellectually or not, the philosophy will tell us that. The philosophy will teach us that. Now, we also have definition of philosophy within the mystical tradition, you know, within Irfan. For example, the most famous ones were the Ismailis, to begin with, who were of sort of mystical nature in terms of their approach to philosophy. And they were the one who, kind of like influenced Sohrawardi, who was also a great mystic or a philosopher, who really coined the term of hikmah, you know, within the Islamic philosophy. The term hikmat was used. Hikmah was used by Sohrawardi first. So let me just quickly read, and perhaps you have already read. The Ismaili thought have emphasized a greater deal on the relationship between theoretical aspect of philosophy, right, and its practical dimension, between thinking philosophy and leading a virtuous life. So a philosopher is considered to be someone who leads a virtuous life, someone who leads the best life, someone who lives ethical, you know, pure life, is led by a philosopher, because he has come to that understanding of these divine realities and principles. You know, when he is analyzing light, he's analyzing light in the light of God. He's analyzing the existence that is around him in the light of God. He is dividing all of these existence into different grades in the light of God. So therefore, a philosopher is considered to be someone who leads that virtuous life. This becomes more evident from Sohrawardi. Sohrawardi also, if we look at the period of Sohrawardi, was 1155. He was born and he was executed or killed or hanged in 1191. by the mullahs themselves. You know, he was known as the heretic. You know, unfortunately, there has always been an issue with the philosophers and the fuqaha. Even today, we find that difference. You know, the fuqaha or the outward zahiri scholars, those who just stick to the zahir, have always given trouble to the philosophers, because they say that, you know, one should not really think of God. One really have to accept. One really have to blindly accept. One should not challenge the doubts that one have. You know, one should avoid these doubts. So therefore, Sohrawardi was basically, a fatwa was given, a verdict was given, where he was hanged on the belief system that he had in relation to his beliefs. Then you have the Ikhwan. Ikhwan is, they are also known as quite famous. They are known as the Bradaran of Purity. Ikhwan, who were basically contemporary to Ibn Sina. You know, Ibn Sina is around 980 AD. He was born and he died in 1037 AD. So that period you also have Ikhwan. Ikhwan were also Ismailis. Ismaili. Ibn Sina was also Ismaili. The beginning of philosophy is the love of the sciences. Its middle, knowledge of the reality of the existence to the measure of human ability. So whatever ability we have to know the reality, whatever ability we have. Now, just an example. The Quran says that whatsoever is in the heaven and earth, they are doing tasbih of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. Yusabbihu lillahi ma fis samawati wal ard. So do we have the ability to really listen to this tasbih that whatever is in the heaven and earth is doing? Do we have the ability to really listen how a tree is doing the zikr of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala or not? So that's what the philosopher wants. You know, he wants to achieve that ability. He wants to have that knowledge. When Quran is saying that everything is doing zikr of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, how it is doing? Shall we just blindly accept? Yes, you can accept. Well and good. But don't we really want to know that how they are doing? Don't we really want to hear that how they are doing? How much of an impact that will have in our faith when we could hear, you know, the clouds doing zikr of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, when the trees are doing the zikr of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, how much of an impact that would have? So that's what philosophy is all about. So here, and it's N words and deeds in accordance to with knowledge that the philosopher have gained. Sohrawardi was the founder of a new intellectual perspective in Islam, which is considered as Hikmatul Ishraq. Hikmatul Ishraq is one of the most important works of Sohrawardi in Islamic philosophy, and it's one of the most important texts that even taught in the Hausa today privately, which is known as Falsafa Ishraq. It's called the School of Illumination. You know, he established a school of, his philosophy, you know, the Illuminist philosophy, which is more Platonic ideas rather than peripatetic. There are two major schools within the Greek philosophy. That one is peripatetic philosophy, which is deductive, which is based on logic and logical discussion. Then you have the Platonic philosophy, which is based on the archetypes, which is more spiritual, which have, I would say, more of a spiritual texture or element to it. So Sohrawardi kind of revived that tradition of Platonic philosophy within the Islamic world. And according to him, philosophy must be realized within one's whole being, our whole wujud, our whole existence. You know, one have to really realize that philosophy. You know, one have to live philosophy. Not only mentally, you know, just believe, conceptualize, deduct, understand, prove, but one must come out of one's body. You know, there's a error there in terms of the spelling error. One's body and ascend to the world of lights. You know, he talked about these lights, divine lights. You know, and as a matter of fact, whatever exists is nothing but light. You know, it's a different levels of light. You know, even the matter that is light. You know, if you look at the essential aspect of this physical matter, is nothing but dense light. You know, it's a sort of like a very heavy light. You know, our bodies are all hollow. You know, we think that it is a body, but it's in reality it's hollow. Even not only philosophically, you know, Jupiter, what is Jupiter? It looks like a big, you know, planet, like a solid, the biggest planet, isn't it? But it's nothing but hollow, you know, one could pass through it. And for our bodies, things could pass through it. But we think that nothing could pass through it, but it could pass through it, right? It's all particle, it's hollow. So it's nothing but light, right? It's a different grades of light, different levels of light. So one really have to ascend to these higher lights, you know, through understanding and living philosophy. The most famous of them, you have the Mullah Sadra, you know, Sadruddin Shirazi. You know, we are looking at now, you know, 16th century now, who kind of brought that revolution, who did that mutation of, you know, the Senan thought, the peripatetic thought, and the Platonic thought. You know, he synthesized that, and he came up with Hikmatul Mutaliyah, which is considered as the transcendental philosophy, you know. And his famous work is the 7th volume, which is that book of on Hikmat, where he wrote in one of the villages of Qom, which is called Kahar. When he came to Qom to do ziyarat, they stoned him and they kicked him out from there. So he took refuge in one of the caves in the village, which is near Qom, that exists today as well. And in this cave, he wrote this treatise of Hikmah, you know, the transcendental philosophy, which is about 7 volume, and it is one of the philosophical texts taught today in the Hawza of Qom, you know. And basically, he was very amazing, you know. Other than this book, there are many other books that he has contributed, and he seems to be the founder of the contemporary philosophical thought within the Shia school. And not only that, it is very unfortunate that he hasn't been investigated as in philosophy at large, you know. And his philosophy is known to be the best of philosophy, you know. We are not talking about just within the Islamic, but in terms of the philosophy as a school of philosophy, you know, the philosophers that have been there. And still people are working on his philosophy and trying to introduce him. You know, that's one of the things that we lack, is that we haven't really introduced Islamic sciences, Islamic knowledge to the West. And they are unaware of. And based on these media or some certain, you know, shallow understanding of certain Orientalists and writers who have written about Islam, they say, okay, Islam, that's what Islam is all about. They haven't really read and understood, you know, the in-depth reality of Islam. Leave aside Islam and the Imams and the Prophet and the Quran, they haven't really understood the philosophers that Islam have given to the world. Mullah Sadra accepts the meaning of Hikmah as understood by Sohrawardi, you know, which is living, which is lights, and then expands the meaning of falsafa to include the dimension of illumination and realization implied by Ishraqi and also Sufi understanding of the term. Now, when a person is philosophizing the reality around him, when he is using his aql to really understand things around him and himself, he will enter a realm of spiritual reality. When he enters this realm of spiritual reality, he will witness and he will see things. Perhaps he could see an angel, masalan, you know, because that is spiritual being. Or even dreams, for instance. Or he could see himself out of body, you know. Or he could really be illuminated by someone who is very far away, or who is a teacher, or who is an imam. You know, as they say that, I think those were the best days and best teachers and best students. Sohrawardi, the way he used to teach class, everybody will come in the class, will sit, and he will sit as well, and he will illuminate all the knowledge from heart to heart. He will not speak. Everything is read and studied, and everybody will leave. You know, that will be the best way to teach here, right? You know, we would not be sitting here preparing the laptop, running around. You know, we'll just sit quietly, and you know, everything will be transferred, you know, heart to heart. Right? So therefore, you know, when a person, what is that reality? You know, that sort of telepathy, you know, the reality of telepathy and reaching there. reaching in our heart. And this has been seen. You know, I was informed by, in regards to Ayat Bahjat, and a student from Malaysia, you know, a lady, a sister who came to study to in the house of Qum, by seeing Ayatullah Bahjat in her dream, where he called her to come to Qum and study. And she comes to Qum, and she goes to the masjid where Agha Bahjat used to live, may Allah bless his soul. And Agha Bahjat, when she comes to the namaz, to the jama'ah prayer, to the congregation prayer, he stops while leaving to say salam to that sister who have come. Otherwise, it was very strange that, obviously, as you know, that tradition that the ulama, the scholars, they don't really, you know, mingle or kind of give time as such to the ladies who are there as well. You know, they bless, they look at them. But he stood there to really speak, to say, you know, welcome to that. How it happened? It happened in dreams. You know, she saw, he never met Agha Bahjat in life, maybe might have heard about Agha Bahjat. And that sort of tell you, what is that reality? You know, what is that? You know, traveling in that state. So that's what it's trying to point out to. Mullah Sadra have a book called Shawahid al-Rububiyyah, which are the witnesses of the Lordship of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, how God is, you know, and how He manifests, how He, you know, what is His reality. You know, he has written a book on that. So that's what, you know, he kind of combined the Platonic thought with that logic and philosopher intellectualizing basically these realities. Then you have this concept of philosophy of discovering the truth concerning the nature of things and mental knowledge with the purification and perfection of one's being has lasted to this day, even today. Purification of oneself, meaning that tazkiyah, you know, not committing sin, adhering to the mustahabbat, the prayers, namaz-e-shab, du'as, all of these things, they really help our philosophy or our knowledge, our aql, our intellect, to really come to a deeper understanding of things. So it was more of a practical way, you know, through our spiritual exercises, we understand the, you know, higher truths. Then you have the 20th century masters, for example, that these were all recent philosophers. You know, Mirza Ahmad Ashtiani, you know, you have Sayyid Muhammad Kazim Assar, then you have Muhammad Hussain Tabatabai, Imam Khomeini, all of these were contemporary philosophers, Sabzawari. You know, this picture on the colored picture, which is a drawing, a painting of Mullah Sadra. You know, I don't know whether he looks like. Right after him is Allama Tabatabai. The next to him is Mullah Hadi Sabzawari, the 19th century philosopher. One of his famous work is Shari Manzuma, which is taught in the Hawza today as well as a philosophical text. And next to him is Imam Khomeini. Now, where is the place of the Quran and Hadith within Islamic philosophy? You know, we talked about logic, we talked about the reality of things and dividing these things into different, you know, in species and genus and so on and so forth. But what about Quran? What about Hadith? You know, why? That's what the Fuqaha says. You know, these philosophers, they really talk about all of these intellectualization, these intellectual concepts, you know, which is far away from Quran. You know, one should always read Quran, one should always pray, one should only listen to Hadith. You know, that one should be really, you know, make oneself busy in these things rather than spending time and learning about philosophy. Now, where is the place of Quran and Hadith within the Islamic philosophy? As mentioned earlier, the Western critics to the Islamic philosophy assert it's simply a Greco-Alexandrian philosophy in Arabic dress. So, like we said, that there's no such thing as Islamic philosophy. It's all nothing but translation and whatever is there. You know, Islamic philosophy is indebted, is all nothing but translation, as they say, whose sole purpose was to transmit certain important elements of Greek philosophy to the medieval West. Nevertheless, the Orientalists seem to be right, because if the philosophy were to left in the hands of the West during the Dark Ages, nothing of today's advancement of the West would have achieved. You know, as we know what the Dark Ages were and how the knowledge survived. You know, the Dark Ages, which we are talking about 16th century, the knowledge remained today, whether that be philosophical knowledge or whether that be, you know, scientific in the sense that we have today in terms of sciences, chemistry, physics, mathematics. You know, that all remained because of Islamic philosophers, because of Islamic scholars. You know, the 101 discoveries, CNN have published an article long time back, you could Google it, about Muslim inventions, 101 in Muslim inventions. They just talked about 101 and how Western civilization is indebted to the Muslim scholars in terms of the hospitals, in terms of mathematics, in terms of flying. You know, it was not Wright brothers. We think it was Wright brothers, but it was, you know, Islamic scholars who initiated that thought of humans could fly, and they started sort of experimenting different ways how an insan could fly. You know, Google that article. It's a good article. If you go through CNN, they still have that. I recently checked it. So that's what the Western Orientalists tend to say. So what was saved, and the advancements that we have today of the West, is because Muslims, for them, knowledge was very important. You know, as it says that it is the responsibility, it is the farida of every Muslim and Muslima, you know, for ladies and gents, for both male and female, it's a responsibility to seek knowledge. So knowledge was very important to them, and they acquired knowledge, they saved knowledge, they worked for it day and night, you know, for ilm. You know, they struggled for it, for ilm, and they protected it. And the way they protected it, by writing complicated texts purposely. You know, they would write, for example, texts in a very complicated fashion so that people will not sort of kind of like misuse the knowledge which we see today. For example, today when we see the separation of church and state, so to speak, or the secular science that is there, as they have taken God out of the equation completely. But those scholars who were, you know, who struggled for knowledge, they knew that, you know, knowledge without God is no knowledge. Al-ilmun la yanfa. You know, that's what we ask, right? In the dua of Taqibat of Asr, we say, O Allah, provide bring not with the knowledge which have no benefit. You know, Allahumma inni asaluka. You know, we say that, you know, salatun la turfa wa du'aun la yusma. Al-ilmun la yanfa. A knowledge that have no benefit. So a knowledge without God is have no benefit. And we have seen Hiroshima, Nagasaki, because it was no God in it. If there was God in it, they will never kill people. No, knowledge is to benefit mankind, not to destroy mankind. So therefore, the reason why these Arabic texts or Persian texts, you know, poetry, so on and so forth, were so complicated was for a purpose and for a reason. And the reason could be clearly seen today. I hope you have read the slide. I will go to the next because we are running out of time. The Quran as a source of ultimate knowledge for all of the Islamic philosophers. The Quran became the supreme source of knowledge, not only of religious law, but of the very nature of existence and beyond existence, of the very source of existence. When an Islamic philosopher approach things, so to speak, wujud, existence around him, he will approach it from the Quranic point of view. You know, as the wujud, kama huwa wujud, you know, the wujud, qua wujud, existence, qua existence. You know, that will be his approach. And that is why you tend to see, for example, the famous Surawar Sabzawari poetry, where he says that it's very difficult to define wujud. You know, wujud, existence is all around us. And the wujud of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala as well. Because a wujud, an existence, if it is defined, the definition have to be clearer. But the existence is more clear, you know, than the definition. You know, how can that be defined? You know, that is his first line of poetry in that book of philosophy. Meaning that the definition must be clearer than the thing defined. But the more clearest and apparent and clear thing is the wujud itself, whether that be the wujud of Allah. You know, that is the most apparent thing. You know, how can you define God? Because define God is so clear. You know, definition cannot be clearer than God, right? God is the clearest, right? So therefore, he really surrenders. So that thinking or that approach is a very Quranic approach. It's not, oh, I think or my intellect. No, it says that, you know, Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala is the most apparent and clear thing. So there is no definition for it. So for them, Quran was the supreme source of knowledge, you know, for all of the philosophers. The nature of wahi, revelation, has always been considered beyond comprehension. They always say that wahi is of a higher level, is of a different realm. You know, we could logically, intellectually come to the understanding of the physical or even sort of spiritual realities that is there, such as dreams, such as the realm of the angelic realm, but wahi is higher than that, it is beyond that. So they considered that to be beyond comprehension. Nevertheless, it was discussed, you know, they discuss wahi and the reality of wahi, you know, for the establishment of his authenticity. It was critically examined and investigated and unanimously accepted it as a source of ultimate knowledge by all philosophers. So for those who come, those, like for example, we find today in the contemporary world who tend to criticize wahi, saying that it was for that period only. You know, today the intellect of insan, the aql of man, have reached to a level that there is no need of wahi. At that time they required wahi, the Prophet required wahi, you know, Allah supported through wahi. But today man is very intelligent. And he has reached to a point that he doesn't need wahi. So that is why the Quran, which it talks about, you know, lashing, it talks about, you know, two witness of a woman compared to one witness, is for that period. It's not for this period. But that's not the case. You know, wahi is a divine reality that is beyond comprehension. You know, a person sort of wants that wahi that have revealed, which is the Quran, the angels who have brought that, that is abad, that is ever living. These raw rules and regulations that are there in the Quran, it is us who are not understanding, you know, the reality of it. You know, I have kind of like purposely used those sort of arguments that the West or the Orientalists tend to criticize about two witness, about heritage, for a purpose which we could discuss that, why is that, you know, later on. This is not the place. But what I'm saying is that this wahi, the revelation, as many of the modern Islam Muslim philosophers tend to say, that this Quran or this wahi was for the man who lived during that period. Today man have advanced, his aql is takmil, is perfect, you know, he could understand things, he could make his own laws, human rights, he could make laws how to govern, you know, what is beneficial for humanity and mankind. You know, he has that aql now, he doesn't need wahi, so he doesn't need Quran, right? But true philosopher, you know, they believe that, you know, this revelation, this wahi, is beyond comprehension, it's a reality. And they not only believe in the sense that blindly, but they have reached to the threshold, you know, to the level where they could see that divine light of wahi. And they say that it's beyond that. It cannot be explained what it is. One have to reach there. One have to enter that realm of wahi. That is why, you know, the wahi used to come to the awliya, to the imams, for instance. Jibreel used to come to the imams as well. But that is not wahi mursal, meaning that wahi as a message to be given to mankind, the same way as the Quran was. You know, that was a different kind of wahi. You know, Jibreel used to attend, Jibreel used to come. But a different type of revelation that was. The clear shift of understanding of aql among the Islamic philosopher, that of Greek understanding, you know, Aristotelian understanding, is the greatest proof of the originality of Islamic philosophy. The way Aql is analyzed in the Greek philosophy is very different to the way Aql is analyzed or understood in Islamic philosophy. For Islamic philosopher, Aql is Ubida Behir Rahman, meaning that Aql, intellect, is servant of Rahman. You know, Aql is someone who basically surrenders to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. That's what true Aql means. You know, as we were talking about earlier, you know, Taslim, you know, that's Aql. That's a true Aql. So that's how they define Aql as. The theoretical intellect is there, yes, there is Aql Nazari. No. The Aql Nazari for Islamic philosophy is no longer that of Aristotle, although his very terminology is translated in Arabic, that it is Nazari. The Aql Nazari, which is the epistemological tool of all philosophical activity, Islamicized in a very subtle way. The clarity is understood when Mullah Sadra discusses this in the commentary of Usul-e-Kafi, or certain verses of the Quran, how he basically interprets certain verses of the Quran, certain hadiths of the Usul-e-Kafi. And if you look at Al-Tabai, also wrote a commentary on Biharul Anwar in a very intellectual way, which was criticized by the scholars, you know, by Borojerdi, by ulama in the past, by the fuqaha, where he was stopped. It wasn't published and it's still not published. Once again, you have that sort of ikhtilaf, because these hadiths and riwayat were interpreted in a very intellectual fashion, you know, in a very philosophical way, rather than being taken as very literal. So the same way, you know, Mullah discusses the verses of the Quran. There's a tafsir of Mullah Sadra, and also on the hadith of Usul-e-Kafi as well. Now, that's the deep point. It's well known among all Muslims, and particularly to students of Islamic tradition, that there is zahir, an outward and batin aspect to the Quran, the zahiri and batini. Hence, the philosophy is considered by the Islamic philosopher to the inward aspect, as we said. The batini aspect is interpreted in that fashion, which, however, we do find that many those who designate their life to the zahir have heavily criticized philosophy and philosophers to the extent of heretics, Surawardi, and even till today we find that. Furthermore, we do find many who had been experts in the outward aspect of the law were experts or lived according to the inward or philosophical ethos, like Imam Khomeini is the greatest example, who was a mujtahid, but at the same time he was a champion of the inward aspect, the batini aspect as well. Or Allama Tabatabai, who was mujtahid in his full right, who adheres to the Sharia and to the law, and at the same time, inwardly, he was a philosopher. Or Ayatollah Jawadi Amali today, for example, he's a mujtahid, he's a marja, and at the same time, he is a philosopher. So there isn't any ikhtilaf, difference among being someone who adhere to the Sharia, to the Zahir, and to the Batin. This is one of the hadiths of Imam Sadiq alayhi salam in regards to Plato and Aristotle. Hazrat Idris, you know, belonging to the chain of prophecy, is regarded as the origin of philosophy. Enoch, you know, he is known as to be the origin of philosophy, while he is also bestowed with the title of Abul Hukama, the father of philosophy. Pheno, you know, one of the recorded, or the first prehistoric philosopher, and certain later Greek philosophers were held in high esteem among the Muslim traditions. So Hazrat Idris alayhi salam, who was a prophet, is considered by the Greek philosophers as a very important philosopher. So you see, the philosophers were considered as men of God, and even the Quran have recorded them as prophets. Al-Hakim, which is the name of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, More specifically, many Islamic philosophers considered Luqman, Hazrat Luqman, as also a philosopher. We gave Luqman al-Hikmah, you know, clearly mentioned. And when we give Hikmat to someone, we have given him Khair. We have given him goodness. So a philosopher who is Hakim, that means Allah have given him the best. You know, because he has this knowledge of the Zahir and the Batin. And the way he will worship will be very different to the person who only have the knowledge of the Zahir. You know, if I know the laws of, you know, how the shakiyat of prayer, what is tahir, what is najasat, I will be stuck there. But if I know the inner reality of najasat and of taharat, and what this najasat and taharat really philosophically mean, and what it will do to my soul, will be very different. The way I will approach the taharat and najasat will be different, because I know the essential reality of this taharat and najasat, the philosophy of taharat and najasat, then just zahiri, I will be avoiding it, right? The Western academia has ignored and neglected the commentaries of Islamic philosophers on Quran and Hadith. The reason, because Islamic philosophy to them was a simple extension of Greek philosophy. And it's being biased. You know, when the West, you know, praises, talks about knowledge, considered itself to be the most advanced, but it's very biased. You know, when it comes to issues, they just don't want to entertain and investigate. They just say that they are very fundamentalists in terms of their own understanding of things, and they call others as fundamentalists. You know, the first major work of commentary upon Quran is by Ibn Sina, then by Surawardi, then Mullah Sadra, then Ibn Turka, etc. You would find even till today Allama Tabatabai and Imam Khomeini have some lectures on tafsir, or of tafsir of Surah Hamdur. Allama Jawadi Amali is doing at present. Among the contemporary works of commentary is of Mizan, the most famous. Do we have time? Okay.
We have some questions.
Yes, we can take some questions. Perhaps that will kind of relieve the concentrated.